We'll go ahead and get started. Good afternoon. I'd like to ask everyone to get settled, and we'll get started here this afternoon. Welcome. Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Steve Morse from CSIS. We're thrilled today to have with us the distinguished Dr. Peter McGinney, very famous to all of you, I'm sure, for his work. I'll say just a few short words about him in a moment in the introductions. We are also very happy that we've been able to do this event together with Physicians for Human Rights, a terrific group and close partners with us, many of whom are here today. And we'll hear in a moment from Pat Duost. We've asked Pat to come and say a few words of introduction. We're also doing this jointly with our colleagues at the Africa Program, Jennifer Cook and David Hennick, the CSIS Africa Program. So got a number of different interested parties who've come together in order to do this. This is part of a speaker series that's been ongoing since we started the Center on Global Health Policy here at CSIS in the fall. Attempted to really use this period to gather from a number of different authoritative sources reflections on what has happened in this historic and unprecedented period of expanded engagement on global health issues in around the world, particularly on HIV/AIDS, but in related infectious diseases, issues around health systems and human personnel deficits and the like. And now a much even broader debate that goes on. And we've I think, helped create a discourse here, a set of reflections about what's worked and what's not worked, and trying to convey where the most enduring and important impacts have been seen. And we're hoping, Peter, that we'll hear from you on that. We're also in the middle of a couple of interlocking profound transitions that call into question sort of what lies ahead in this next phase. Clearly, we've moved from a period of euphoric and well and amply funded expansion and of budgets and of political commitments and the like into a period of worsening global economic crisis and worsening uncertainty around where the bottom lies and what the sacrifices and trade-offs are going to be in that period. So it's forced a reappraisal. It's forced an even tougher consideration of what the real impacts are for the investments made and how do we get greater efficiencies, how do we bring about greater streamlining and a strategic focus on what really matters in this phase looking forward, and how do we preserve and sustain and accelerate the historic gains and the achievements that have been made and bring those across to publics here and in Uganda and elsewhere, publics that live in a period of worsening personal insecurity and familial insecurity that becomes itself a potentially quite a new variable in how we think these things through. We also are obviously in a period of a new administration. And we'll hear quite a bit, I hope, Peter, in terms of your reflections of the achievements of the first five-year phase of PEPFAR. We've been writing about this. Others have been writing about this. It's great that we can have you come here and offer us a summary view. We're in the early phases of the new Obama administration and the new Congress. This is an administration that has its leaders have embraced in different forms and different moments while in the Senate and while elsewhere, embraced the objectives and the goals of the PEPFAR program and the PEPFAR reauthorization. It's also an administration that's struggling with the questions around foreign assistance reform, about what its own signature initiatives will be in this period. And there's a number of ideas, and it's early days in terms of leadership, in terms of strategy and the like. Having you come here and speak today is very timely, I believe, very timely in getting a very important voice like yours out on the record on some of these issues around both looking back and reflectively about what has been achieved, what's worked, what's not worked, looking forward in terms of what should be the priorities, what should be the next priorities, how do we begin to rationalize and justify this next phase in terms of the programs that will matter most to us. Peter, since 1992, has been the executive director of Uganda's Joint Clinical Research Center, which is both clinical and research lab that has provided leadership in the area of HIV/AIDS prevention and antiretroviral treatment. And in that role, he led the single largest treatment initiative in Africa funded through the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. And I think that fact alone is terribly important as we hear what you're going to share with us. Peter chairs the Africa Dialogue on AIDS and the AIDS Care Research in Africa, two African-led initiatives coordinate HIV/AIDS-related activities throughout the continent. He serves as Chancellor of Uganda's Mbarara University of Science and Technology. He was recognized for his achievements and for his international leadership during the 2003 State of the Union Address, the January 28th famous address in which then President Bush announced the creation of PEPFAR. He received his medical training at Makerere University in Kampala and the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons in Glasgow. Peter, before we begin and turn to you, I would like to ask Pat to speak briefly, very briefly, on the PHR program. So welcome, and thank you, Pat.
Thank you very much. Whoa. For those of you who are not familiar with PHR, I just wanted to give you a little bit of a background. Physicians for Human Rights is an advocacy organization that mobilizes healthcare professionals, all healthcare professionals, physicians, nurses, public health specialists, and students. And what we do is we advance the health and dignity of all people by protecting human rights. And we use the voices of our constituents throughout the world to help bridge the gaps between scientific research and U.S. global health policy. The Health Action AIDS campaign, which I have the fortune to direct, we focus on developing a comprehensive approach to the global AIDS epidemic through the development and implementation of a rights-based response to this epidemic. We advocate for evidence-based programs and access to comprehensive prevention and care programs for all those living with HIV, but particularly the most marginalized, women and injection drug users. We also focus on robust funding of PEPFAR and other global responses to this epidemic. The last 5 years, we actually made promises to millions of people, particularly in Africa, living with HIV. And we are on the road to success. We fear that this is not the time to back down on those promises, in spite of what we are all well aware of the U.S. domestic economic situation. Over the last 5 years, we have also partnered with many advocacy organizations on the ground in Africa, particularly Rwanda, Kenya, and Uganda. Our partnership with the Action Group for Human Rights in Africa, in Uganda, is what allows us to bring Dr. Peter Mgeni here today to speak with all of you. He is our guest, and we are so proud to host him. Peter and PHR are going to be here for the week, and we have one agenda, one key message, and it is to robustly fund a fully authorized PEPFAR. And we need your voice to help support this. We're well aware that in the last few weeks, we have found dollars, millions, billions of dollars to support certain multi-billion dollar corporations and their CEOs in spite of questionable performance. We know PEPFAR works. We know how to save lives. We now need a small fraction of that investment to go towards the global response that we're able to give. So I thank you all for being here today, and I look forward to your support. And remember, we need your voice. So thank you.
Thank you for your kind introduction and kind words. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming to listen to me and to share a bit of what we have been doing in Uganda and maybe to share my reflections regarding where I think we should be moving with PEPFAR. I bring you greetings from Uganda, and it is the country that is ranked number 10 with highest cases of AIDS in the world. Right from the beginning, I want to go straight to PEPFAR and focus on what we have achieved with PEPFAR. You saw the title. It goes back to a decade. I don't want to go back, because before PEPFAR, the situation in Africa was a situation of doom. It was total chaos. People are dying en masse. It is a situation that would like to forget, but we can't, because we have lessons for the future from that situation. So the success of PEPFAR started actually right from the beginning, even before it started. This is one of those rare programs that got bipartisan support in the US, and it has since become America's biggest humanitarian initiative. It has changed the face of America from a world policeman to Africa's friend, a world's friend. It proved the feasibility of such a big humanitarian initiative. If you look back 10 years ago, this was thought impossible. But PEPFAR has proved it is possible. It achieved more than it set out to do. It extended beyond HIV and malaria and TB, and it has positively influenced other health services and contributed to capacity building in Africa. The highlights of PEPFAR are quite thrilling, but top of it all, it has saved lives. That's the message of PEPFAR. It has saved lives. We've had in Africa 10 times increase of people on antiretroviral therapy to over 3 million, and PEPFAR is contributing a big number, over 2.1 million. Are supported by PEPFAR, but what really is the most obvious sign is that people are no longer dying en masse like they used to do. As I said, it has gone beyond just treatment. About 4 million orphans have had some help from PEPFAR. In prevention, over 2 billion condoms have been distributed, and then we have had a strong prevention of mother-to-child program reaching 16 million pregnancies, and it has established an impressive number of partnership of 2,600, including my own, the Joint Clinical Research Center. So when we look at the main achievement of PEPFAR, we need to look in those areas where we thought it would not work, in rural areas. It has reached there. And we need to see how people are doing on treatment. It used to be said Africans would not do well on treatment. They would not keep time. But all of that has been proved false. We are doing very well. Adherence of our patients is excellent. It equals what we get here, and in some cases surpasses it. And treatment outcome is as good as anywhere else. We've had diagnostic and monitoring tests introduced in some areas, as I will elaborate. And this has been a great success, having the state-of-the-art tests in some remote places, although, as I will mention later, the public sector still needs more support in that area. In the interest of time, I'll just touch on the outlines of how this has been done by my center, the Joint Clinical Research Center. We have had a strong information and communication program aimed at mobilizing the people so that we are not just taking treatment to them. Our approach has been we are taking treatment together with the community. We have had to mobilize available resources and infrastructure. Whatever we found there, we made it work because we are dealing with an emergency, and we've had task shifting. Where we didn't have doctors, nurses have done the job. Where we didn't have nurses, other paramedics have come in. But we have used all means to try and behave like we are dealing with an emergency. And where it has been necessary, we have improvised. But right from the beginning, our planning has been clear. We didn't want to just deal with an emergency. We realized we needed to incorporate sustainability strategies in our program of addressing infrastructure in a stepwise manner. We realized human resource was a big challenge, and we started planning for it, as I will show briefly. And we needed to plan for gradual integration into the continuum of care. And all of those things, we had them on board. So wherever we went, we'd find infrastructure like that. And whenever we found infrastructure like this, we are lucky. But with PEPFAR support, that infrastructure now looks like this. This is just a small change of just renovation. What it does for morale, what it does to staff motivation is unimaginable. You just see it. It is palpable by just improving on infrastructure. Training has been going on, and we do have partners with people like MSH and others who come over to work with us on training people. And these include community members who are proudly displaying their certificates, now able to take on roles that deal with the emergency. And the Joint Clinical Research Center has been able, with PEPFAR support, to set up all of those centers. We set up within 5 years 50 centers in all parts of the country. And we had, in addition, 6 centers of excellence which have been set up. You see they are geographically distributed so that each center serves a region as a referral center and knowledge hub, so that people in those particular regions go to these centers to get training, to learn good practices, and to be able to take back the knowledge they acquire into their villages, into their areas, so that work can go on. Most pleasing of all is that in those centers of excellence, we've been able to set up some laboratories, and these laboratories are helping to provide referral services for some of the sophisticated tests that we'll talk about. Now, 10 years ago, we used to talk about inability of Africa to host some of the most sophisticated tests. One of the most sophisticated tests is early infant diagnosis, DNA PCR. This is not done in capital Kampala. Each region of the country is able to do DNA PCR. They don't need to bring it to Kampala. At the bottom, you can see a slide from UNITAID, Clinton Foundation, which is showing accelerated number of children who are accessing treatment in 33 countries. We are now talking of saving literal lives. If you are late in diagnosing children, then there is a big problem. Now, we need to look at other PEPFAR accomplishment. I don't know whether there is actually another slide. We've had adherence program. You know, antiretroviral therapy appears sophisticated to many people. It's not. If you can ensure that your patients are adherent, you achieve great success with it. We've had great communication strategy and a program called Treat for Life, which has been rolled out countrywide. We've had and produced IEC materials, information, education, and communication materials. We have had logistics for drugs, laboratories, and equipment maintenance. And we have had support supervision. Support supervision is to train people in best practices. There are situations of extreme poverty. This family comes from the forest. It is the impenetrable forest. It is very thick. It extends from Uganda border to Rwanda and Congo. And these people, they have HIV. The incidence is rising. We have implemented a prevention program. And these people use antiretroviral very well. And they are benefiting from PEPFAR, even in their extreme poverty. Now, this is the picture that we are seeing. This picture is not seen in Uganda alone. This is our program alone. Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania, wherever PEPFAR is, they have got a similar graph showing the uptake has been really excellent. So, what is the state of the epidemic in Uganda currently? We have a prevalence rate of 6.4. Among the adult population. We still have got about a million people living with AIDS. We have got about a million children who have been orphaned by HIV/AIDS. We have had about 130 new infections in 2007 alone. And we have had 78,000 pregnant women with HIV. These are women who are benefiting from prevention of mother to child. And currently, those on treatment are about 150 from a very small number before PEPFAR. And 12,000 of these are children. So before we go to challenges, I like to say, in summary, that is the outline of what PEPFAR has been able to achieve in a period of about 5 years, from a non-existent program. So really, I think PEPFAR's achievement have been quite impressive. Now, the challenges. Even before PEPFAR one started, there were some issues. Some contentious issues arose as it was starting. Some people tried to have undue emphasis on abstinence until marriage only program and allocated disproportionately more money to it. There was some resistance to integration with family planning activities, and there were some concern whether PEPFAR would affect adversely other health programs and undermine some crucial programs like education and agriculture, which are crucial for a developing country. I'm very glad to say most of these turned out to be unfounded. But let's go to UNAIDS. UNAIDS has come out with some data showing some milestones that have been reached. And they are talking about 3 million people being treated and decline in numbers of new infections from 3 to 2.7 million. They are talking about fewer infected individuals dying. And they are also talking about more people on treatment, about 1 million in 1 year alone, 2007. But we always need to keep in mind the reality of AIDS treatment, because even physicians sometimes get to forget a simple fact. When we treat people with antiretroviral therapy, their lives are saved. There is absolutely no doubt about this. But the definition of saving their lives means continuity of treatment. The moment we stop, the clock starts ticking. or will have done is to postpone their death. So unless treatment is sustainable, we always need to keep it in mind. Treatment must be sustainable. Otherwise, we are only postponing death. And another issue that we always need to keep in mind is that it is impossible to have a successful public sector AIDS treatment program where some people get therapy and others in dire need don't. We need to keep this. And we need to know the imperative nature of this, that if people always come in families, it becomes critical if some members of the family get treatment and others don't. So this is what we need to keep in mind. So we need to talk about the continuing challenges. And these continuing challenges is that PEPFAR has not coped with the numbers. We are in Uganda, we are only having about half of those in need receiving treatment. 12,000 children out of 60,000 in need of treatment are getting it. Infrastructure and human resource deficiencies remain a serious constraint. Many rural areas remain without treatment and services. There is internal brain drain. And then laboratories are very few and many are in a miserable state. PEPFAR has also not kept up with the preventive intervention, so we need to reach out to new risk groups. AIDS evolvement is highly dynamic. New situations are always coming. So we need new preventive strategies, and we have had new initiatives come up like male circumcision. And then women are increasingly being infected with HIV, much more than men. If you take the case of young women, age 18 to about 25, young women are three times more likely to be infected with HIV than men. So we need special targets to target this new risk group. And then there has been no consistent systemic policy for health sector system strengthening, and this is important for eventual sustainability. All over sub-Saharan Africa, these are the kind of laboratories that you find. This is a provincial hospital, and actually teaching hospitals are also no different from that. That does terrible things for morale and motivation. And when you go to other laboratories, you see these. They use microscopes. These are microscopes that use light. That's why they are near the window. And this other chap near that other window is trying to look for a malaria parasite, and you can see what is happening on his window and the little information that he can get out. And in some situation, you find what they call laboratory sans murs. That is laboratory without walls. And these are some of the situations that we meet and we need to address. So some perspective from the ground. Second phase of PEPFAR, 2009 to 2013. As a healthcare provider, I think I start to look at the moral and ethical dilemma which we face, faced by healthcare providers. They are community concerns, because currently no new patients can now be started on therapy. I was discussing with Steve and others that this situation is just not tenable. Because we have had many hundreds of thousands who have been tested, and we have had many people living with AIDS, HIV AIDS, who are in care. These people get regular checks for CD4, and we've been following them over years and supporting them, and they are waiting for the time when they will start treatment. Now, having been in care, expecting to get treatment when they need it, it is very difficult to have to inform them that now you cannot go on treatment when time comes for them to need it. So that's why I said freezing is not a tenable situation. There are people who phoned me. Recently, we issued a statement to all of those centers you saw on the map that we have difficulty getting any more drugs for you. So please give priority to people who are already on treatment. Then they phone. What do we tell pregnant women who come? Now, I tell them, well, if you have any drugs inside, just give them the drugs. We'll see how we'll deal with it tomorrow. So that's why the situation of saying freeze at the moment is just not tenable. So this complex situation calls for long-term PEPFAR commitment and increased funding. As I have already said, less than 50% of people are getting treatment. And there is new science has advanced, informing us the best time to start treatment. And this means we have to increase the CD4 level at which we start treatment. And if we do that, almost 1 million patients immediately start needing treatment. Every year, because we have got many patients in care, every year we get about 1 million people who need treatment coming on board. And then for every 2 people that we treat, we still have got 5 who are getting infected. So this situation calls for increased funding. This increased funding is not a bottomless pit. Increased funding will make it possible for us to contain the epidemic eventually. So we need to support capacity building within the public health care, that is the ministries of health, to build sustainable programs. And we need to plan with strong local input and participation so that the transition from crisis management to addressing quality, sustainability, and gradual integration and into an improved national continuum of health delivery becomes possible. Local participation is crucial. And expertise from outside is crucial, but they need to work together. But programs that come purely without local participation are ultimately unsuccessful in the long run. We need to always keep in mind what really is the desirable goal. The desirable goal is universal AIDS care and treatment and a robust preventive program, fully integrated in an improved national health delivery program. We always need to keep this in mind. This is what will make us eventually succeed and sustain a program of this magnitude. And talking about that is talking about strengthening health systems, because this is the key to sustainability and eventual successful transition to national health program. So health systems in Africa are in a crisis. We know that. And without properly functioning health systems, neither disease-specific interventions nor comprehensive health services can achieve satisfactory and sustainable outcomes. This is not a fatalistic statement. The reality is that we know we can do it. So the way to do it is to aim at strengthening health systems. And some components of health systems have been mentioned. It includes human resource, health financing and payments, infrastructure and clinical services, monitoring and evaluation, strategic planning, medical products and technologies, and that's what it used to be. But more recently, health and behaviors has been added on. That's without health rights, it doesn't make full sense. So this is what needs to be done. In the interest of time, so that we can have time for some questions and discussions, I will just mention only a few. I will go in details about some few of these. The most important is the human resource situation. It is critical in Africa. And to achieve Millennium Development Goal, WHO recommended a minimum of 2.3 doctors, nurses, and midwives for every 1,000 population. On average, sub-Saharan Africa has less than half. Now, Africa has only 3% of the world's healthcare workers, and yet 24 of the world of world's disease burden, and using less than 1% of world's expenditure on health. And then those few healthcare providers work in some of the most difficult conditions. This is from World Health Organization giving a picture of the dire conditions of the shortage of healthcare providers in Africa. These are the doctors, and this is the nurse situation, which is no different from that of doctors. So the issue of human resource is very, very important. And the features that need to be addressed include a need to support, train, and retain critical mass of human resource in Africa. And to do this, we need to improve working conditions for the public sector workers, to motivate them, and minimize both internal and external brain drain. And needless to say, sub-Saharan Africa loses about 30% of their doctors and about 11% of their nurses to external brain drain. And the recent number of healthcare providers have been lost in internal brain drain. When you set up some NGOs, they attract better salaries and people move from public sector, to the private sector. We need to think very seriously about the ban on supplementing salaries of public health sector workers. All the NGOs in Africa ultimately depend on public health sector workers. So we need to somehow motivate them, and there is no better way of motivating them than to supplement their salaries so that they can remain in hard-to-reach places where they work and be able to provide the critically needed service. We need to support special incentives for healthcare providers to serve in underserved areas, support new training program, and strengthen existing one. Training is going to be very, very important because we have to create new health workers. And then in the short to medium term, we need to support task shifting, like I said at the beginning. But most of the work is going to be undertaken by community workers, volunteers, and we need to compensate them because they also need something to sustain them as they provide this service. Of course, there is concern about health financing now. It is a topical issue. There is very, very big concern across Africa about the current global financial crisis. That is a very serious concern. But while that is there, we need to harmonize and align calls for a single national strategic framework. These are some of the strategies that will help us maximize the finance we get. If we can harmonize and align national strategic framework, have a single AIDS governing body, single monitoring and evaluation for all programs. This is not always followed in PEPFAR. When it is followed, we'll avoid duplication, and the better funded PEPFAR program will help a national monitoring and evaluation program. So PEPFAR and international health financing need to continue and to contribute to and be part of the general health systems and strengthen it. not only HIV, TB, and malaria, they will fail unless they strengthen the entire health system. So we need to continue dialogue and support development of innovative national strategies. We need to strengthen nations to be in a position to eventually manage the health system in the end. So we need to incorporate a policy for integrating health programs to ensure a well-functioning health system. And there are some ideas on how this could be done. We need to minimize barriers to health services access. We need to promote equity, decrease stigma, transparency, and accountability, and provide more services to more people. With regard to women, this is a special risk group in Africa. There are very many opportunities we need to take to address what I call the women crisis. They are more affected. The epidemic is being feminized. We need to integrate reproductive health, including family planning, with AIDS care services, so that women can more easily access services they normally lose out in Africa. I'll just have just a short comment on this: health rights and behaviors. In whatever we are doing, patients have rights. We don't just go to them and just give them a program and then take it away when conditions are difficult, let it go when it is easy, and so on. We need to respect their rights, their data, their right to choose care providers, their privacy, and patient participation in decision making. We are trying to do that. When you do it, things become easier, cheaper, and you reach more people. And then, of course, the impact of gender on health-seeking behavior. It is very, very important. And we need to promote health-seeking behaviors, health facility utilization, consumer engagement and empowerment, adherence and retention, and above all, involvement of civil society. So as I come to the end of my brief presentation, we need to look at planning for the long term. We need to know AIDS for what it is. It is a multiplier equation in Africa. We have only 3 million on ART. It leaves out an estimated 5 million in immediate need, people who need treatment today. As I said, an additional 1 million will come on if the recommendation of raising the CD4 level from 200 to 350 becomes in effect. Every year, we have 1 million who qualify for ART to add to those already on therapy. The new infection rate remains high. So all of those mean we have to intensify our effort, because continuing success of PEPFAR entails long-term commitment and increased funding. This is the only way to stop the carnage of AIDS in Africa. And this is the only way to prevent a resurgence of a much more vicious scourge. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Dr. McGinney. Jennifer, do you want to come up and join us? Let me offer a few comments. Thank you very much for your presentation. And there's some challenging issues there that you've put before us. One of which is, of course, what happens. I mean, if it turns out that the level of antiretroviral treatment available in Uganda remains flat, or the growth levels are much reduced than what has been the case in the last 5 years, you're suggesting that this creates inevitably worsening social tensions that are going to have to be managed. So I put put that out there as, let's just imagine that that is the case. What do you do about it? What do you do about it internally? Hold that for 1 second while I make one other set of comments, which is more a set of observations. I think here in Washington, or in the United States more broadly, that there is a commitment at a political level to continuing to support, significantly support, the HIV/AIDS program and related infectious disease and global health programs. And we've seen that in some of the early, in the early budget numbers. There's a consensus, but it's a fragile one, and it's an uncertain one, and we are in a period of uncertainty. So I think it's important to remind people of that, and that the those who have been on very involved for a long time are proud and informed and aware of this legacy, this historical legacy, and the need to preserve it, and that it's, that it's sustained and improved the lives of millions, and that it's been a very worthy investment. I also think that we're in a much different context right now. We're in a much different context in which the arguments that have been used for the last 5 or 6 years are less and less effective. That we're in a context of a fundamental game shift, and we have yet to really acknowledge that or understand what that means in terms of the argumentation that's needed and the rationalization for this. And I think you're helping us think that through. But if you look at the dichotomies, I mean, we're out of a phase of expansive budgets in this last decade and into one of enormous debt, deficit, and uncertainty, and a threat that this economic crisis itself will begin to generate new humanitarian disasters and instability, but also will call into risk the overall structure of our economies, both in Uganda and the United States and elsewhere. So this is a much different picture that we're in today. There is an increased consciousness and sensitivity around the sunken long-term costs of providing antiretroviral treatment. And that is a fact, and it's something that we all, as advocates of this, struggle with as a reality. There's also the reality that, by comparison with the key turning points in 2002, 2003, where the perceived threat of HIV as a menace and a destabilizing menace, that perception of threat has diminished significantly, as has the threat of other related infectious diseases on SARS and avian influenza and others have receded. So the perceived threat is down. The economic crisis is very much in the foreground. And our own opinion climate here in the United States is shifting rather rapidly in directions that we don't fully understand. But when you read the survey data that's coming forward, and there's lots of very aggressive survey data underway today trying to track opinion in this country, it's rather unstable. It's definitely moving in the direction of skepticism around putting dollars outside of our borders. We have not seen the translation of that yet into serious budgetary consequences, but it's a fact, and it's moving in that fashion. There's sensitivities now about getting value for dollars invested, and a retrospective look at the broader picture of where dollars have been invested vis-a-vis developmental in areas and different health sectors. So having said that, there's a debate going on. There's a debate about how do you begin to create a new form of realism that defends these investments and preserves further expansion? How do you broaden the approach in order to make it more integrated so that you can keep the antiretroviral treatment alive and as a priority while also demonstrating that you're going to bring broader benefits to mother-to-child transmission or mother and maternal child health, to broader developmental gains on sanitation and water, to reproductive health or agriculture? These issues are very much present today in Congress and in the debates internally within the administration. I think also there's much more concern about getting the prevention agenda on another footing where people can feel confident that the new infection rates are going to drop at a bigger or faster rate, and also that streamlining and getting greater efficiencies, improving impacts, the pressures are going to increase on that to rationalize and streamline approaches. We are struggling with these issues, and it's not a fixed debate. It's not a resolved debate by any means. It's one that's going on in Congress. It's one that's going on among activist groups. It's one that's going on internally within the administration. But I do think that the fundamentally changed context that we're in today has to be sort of the starting point for beginning to make these arguments, because you're going to encounter, I think, here a certain amount of a pushback on the need for this realism and the need for sensitivities around these issues that have suddenly become much more real, around the share of resources that have gone in for this and the long-term carrying costs associated with it. And so far, the arguments that we've seen have appeared to be too defensive versus too forward-looking and too sort of acknowledging this radically different context. So that's a very long-winded way of moving to the discussion, and I apologize. Maybe you could start by offering some comments on what happens if you do face flattened ART levels or much slowed progress or enlargement within Uganda? What does that mean when you have a group that's served and a group that's expectations are to be served, but they're not meeting that? And secondly, how do you reframe the argument in order to get a better reception here in this current setting in the United States?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, you have offered some very very good insights into the problem. And these are the issues that I think makes a strong case. I mean, they are difficult situation. It makes a strong case for not ignoring the HIV AIDS crisis. But let's look at the threat, the diminished perception of the threat. That would be a very unfortunate stand to take. When I came here yesterday, I was met by headlines, I think in the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. And these headlines frightened me. Here, right here in US, we have a disease resurging. And this is coming out of thinking that HIV/AIDS was not a threat anymore in US. Now, if it can resurge in the U.S., you can imagine if we took that position, what it would do to Africa. It would come out as a disaster. So we need to know and to realize that HIV remains a real threat. If you give it a chance, it comes out more reinvigorated. So to address specifically this question, this scenario where you get some people on treatment and others are not on treatment, we get a recipe for a reinvigorated epidemic. So we need to do everything possible, and we know how to do it, stop it. We've had a budgetary authorization last year of about $48 billion. What we need is to try as a minimum to get this money released. It will be able to address all the patients who are on treatment. It will be able to maintain all the preventive program that we have. And on top of that, it will allow us not to have a crisis where we have some people on treatment and others not. We will not have a situation where we will have questions like, what do we with the pregnant women? What do we with the orphans who have got HIV? So this is what we need to keep in mind. That's why I said it's not an option to say we can freeze. If you freeze, you reverse the gains. People won't take treatment. There is no such thing as telling people that now honor you with beyond treatment until we get more money to start those in need on treatment. A good illustration happened before the pre-PEPFAR era. I was in the clinic. A woman came. One day I was busy seeing patients. She just dropped her 1 month treatment on the table and started walking away. I called her back. I said, what did this say? This is my 1 month treatment. I don't want it. So I said, why? Said, I came with my husband and a child. You said you had no children's treatment and you could only afford treatment for me. I can't take it when the rest of my family cannot take treatment. Here is your drugs. Me, I'm going home to die with my family. This is the reality of the situation on the ground. We are dealing with a disease that we need to keep the human situation in mind. So we need to work not only with PEPFAR from US, we need to work with our countries. Our countries are worthy partners. They have a contribution to make, but we need to assist them to be able to make a contribution on a sustainable basis. When we have a financial crisis like we do in the US, this is the time for leadership to come through. The time when there is no financial crisis perhaps is easier, but when we have a financial crisis, this is the time to really show leadership, and the United States can show leadership. It is in a better situation than Africa, who are also facing the global crisis, to be able to do it. And we need to find ways of working together with our governments so that we can override this tragedy.
Thank you. Why don't we go ahead? What we'll do is take three or four questions, comments, and then come back to Peter, and then we'll do another round. Jennifer, did you want to lead off, and then we'll go back to Robert and Sam?
Hi, Jennifer Cook. With the Africa program here at CSIS. And I think in part of making the case, I wondered if you have thoughts or what is your perception on the trend lines in African government spendings on health and what has been the impact of this big infusion. I'm sure it's varied, but let's say in Uganda or in the neighboring countries. Because I think more and more trying to meet African priorities will be important, but there needs to be demonstrable investment by African governments themselves. And I don't think anyone's near reaching the Abuja Declaration percentages, but I wonder what you see the trend generally being.
Okay. Hold on 1 second. We'll get a couple more comments. Just to follow quickly on that, I mean, Margaret Chan has been delivering some very dramatic speeches of late, making the argument in the last big global turndown, the 78 to 82 recession, that health budgets were savaged in that period and took 15 years to recover. And her argument is that there's high probability of that pattern repeating itself, and her hope is to help stem it. But there's historical precedent to health and education budgets taking enormous hits in this period when budgets suffer this. Robert.
Peter, thank you for that. Clear? Thank you for the wonderful presentation. I wanted to pick up on Steve's, I thought, very eloquent remarks about the fact that the game is changing and the arguments need to change as well. And I wanted to ask you to respond with respect to Uganda in two areas, both of which you mentioned in your talk. One is around this question of the integration of HIV/AIDS programs and spending with the rest of health systems. A lot of the criticisms that one hears these days is that the laboratories are beautiful, but they only serve HIV/AIDS tests. The logistics, the supply chain is fantastic for the AIDS drugs, et cetera, but we don't have these spillovers to the rest of the health system. I wonder if you can talk about what's actually happened in Uganda and where you feel that can go further. The other one is what Steve was saying about the emphasis on prevention and more effective prevention going down the pike. You talked about the incidence being about 130,000 per year in Uganda. I think just doing a rough back of the envelope calculation, that's a little under 1% of the adult population. You talked about targets for increasing on the treatment side. What about the targets for reductions in incidence? Just your comments there in terms of whether, in fact, when you talk about sustainability of treatment, the most important sustainability measure, in fact, is to have a stronger prevention program in Uganda. It's great to get more money and to continue to put people on treatment, but unless the incidence falls, we're never going to catch up with the new infections. And as people stay on treatment and are kept alive, the numbers requiring treatment every year will continue to grow.
Yes.
We'll take one more, Sam, up front here. And then we'll come back, and then we'll do a second round.
Hi, Peter. It's always a pleasure to hear you.
Thank you.
A question and a short comment. One is, I know you really don't want to start looking at the if. What if the budget from PEPFAR does not increase?
Yes.
But in reality, you'll be forced to do that. Either now or soon. And the question is, what other sources of funds do you think Africans can mobilize? You've mentioned that some of the countries have to put in a little more money. But you have to be forced to think of where else can you go? Who else can be mobilized to make up for the shortfall? The successes you've shown us were successes that we expected. It was called the JCRC model. The JCRC model, depending on a very good JCRC, like you set up, many other countries don't have this. And it was a system where you set out the center, then you had satellites, and from the satellites, you moved out to the periphery. I was privileged to be there when you went to set up the Kabale. Remember the Kabale Center? At that time, nobody thought that was possible. So many countries don't have a JCRC. Is the JCRC model possible in these countries?
Yes.
What's the best approach to dealing with the situation?
Okay, Peter.
One more.
Go ahead.
Well, thank you for wonderful questions that we have had. Government African spending is very, very important. This is a partnership. And some countries, the target was countries to commit about 15% of budgets to health. And some are moving towards that target. We need to appreciate the competing demands that they have. But that's the way to move. In Uganda, Parliament has passed a motion to increase funding. There is a factory supported by government that is going to be making more cost-effective drugs. We need also to make it cheaper to implement the program, and countries need to make a contribution. So you are absolutely right. Increased contribution by African countries need to go hand in hand with increased support that we are advocating from PEPFAR. There was good comments about integration. And there was an example of labs. I liked that question very much. I can only use our program. Right from the beginning, we took a decision as Joint Clinical Research Center that anywhere we have labs, they must contribute something to the public sector. That's why initially our labs were close to the main public hospital, the regional hospitals. So because the labs would not run without power 24 hours, we had a cable that came from our lab to go to the main hospitals that provided light to operating theater. They used not have some that provided light to emergency, that provided power to the laboratory. Without PEPFAR, this would not have been possible. We had shared pharmacies, and we have had our laboratories provide crucial services to those hospitals. In the second PEPFAR, which is starting, this is what needs to be strengthened. And that's why my emphasis was on building health systems. And this is the background to sustainability, which we need to achieve. Now, there was a good question about if the funding doesn't come, where do you find the money? You need to look for alternatives, absolutely. But the alternatives need to take in account the reality that we have in the world. All countries are faced with global financial challenge, and they have not exempted Africa. And it looks to me that the world needs to ride out this storm together. So we need leadership to be able to mobilize all countries to know that this is not an African issue. If it was a purely African issue, we would not be having HIV rising in the capital of the United States. And when you look at the figures, you break them down. For the blacks here in the United States, they have got the same prevalence as the blacks in Uganda. They talked about 7%. It's exactly the same. 3% in a country like Senegal would be highly unacceptable. Senegal has a rate of 0.8. So we are dealing with a global problem. We are not dealing with a pure African problem. It is catastrophic there, but it looks to me that it has to be tackled on a global level. Then you talked about, yes, the JCRC. Africa is very rich in experiences from so many countries. We had an organization called African Dialogue on AIDS, which aimed at avoiding discovering the wheel. Knowledge is there. We had to share it as Africans. But whenever we went as African Dialogue on AIDS, we found we could learn from virtually all countries. The practice of prevention that has been successful in our organization is now extremely successful in countries like Mozambique. Malawi has surpassed Uganda in the numbers of people it is treating, and yet the condition is extremely poor. Their laboratories are much more poor than we have in Uganda. Zambia is doing much better. So these are some of the initiatives which are in the continent of Africa. Africa is not sitting waiting for aid to be given to us. We are participating very vigorously in trying to emancipate ourselves as partners with the rest of the world. And these initiatives need to continue so that together we get out of this crisis.
Thank you very much. You raised the issue around the epidemic here in Washington and elsewhere in the United States, and the new data that was brought forward last August, just before the Mexico City conference on the U.S. epidemic and the resurgence in several subpopulations that were high risk, that was an embarrassment and a shock, and it got quite a bit of notice in the United States. And the epidemic here and the scale of it and the difficulty and the complexity of it has gotten increasing attention, including politically from our mayor and what you saw yesterday in the Washington Post. That potentially has, it means there's a return to engagement on these issues and that they are very much with us. And that in a way is helpful in this period. And it's helpful that we need to turn our attentions to this. But it's helpful because it brings forward the sort of shared common experience of struggling with this. Let's move to, we have a woman in front. Please identify yourselves and then offer a quick comment or observation. We have a gentleman here and a gentleman there. Yes, please.
Lana Milburn from MSH. Dr. Majeni, thank you so much for the update on Uganda. And even more so, a big thank you for the leadership that you've given the United States government in creating the PEPFAR program. One of the pieces of data that really is often missing, and I think it's probably most important, and it's a piece to convince those people who hold the dollars and the bags of dollars, is that, and it answers this question, in the past 5 years, How has the country's public and private systems been incrementally capacity built so that they can take on more and more ownership of the AIDS crisis? And I'm thinking, you know, and I'm not looking for large gains, but maybe something like new policies, maybe new points of care, maybe more rollout of programs that have been successful, maybe research that's helped the country get a handle on its crisis, maybe more nurses, community health workers giving care, maybe more programs that have been integrated into some kind of a bundle arrangement. So it's those points of incrementally capacity building the country's public and private systems to handle the care.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mujenyi. I'm Christian Achema from the National Academy of Sciences, and I think most importantly, I'm a Ugandan, so I'm excited that you are here today. So my question, I think, will be short. It is has to do again with health systems and this whole thing about the health workers and leadership. Where are the new leaders that are going to take over from you? Where are the new Mujenyis? Where are the new political leaders in health that are going to push for it, the new Mandelas and others? And most importantly, where are our women leaders, the young ones? Are they there being trained under you, Dr. Mujenyi, or others? Is there anything being done?
Harvey Sloan with the Eurasian Medical Education Program. As you saw yesterday in the Post, our transmission in Washington, D.C., in the three major areas has increased, sexual, men, and injecting drug use. I'm wondering, and given the fact that it's increasing mostly around the world, what major preventions have you found to be effective, non-medical preventions? Because we really haven't hit it here in the United States, and we could learn from you.
Oh, thank you, David. It's David Bryden from Infectious Diseases Center for Global Health Policy and Advocacy. just a comment. I think from an objective standpoint, it'd be impossible to maintain that there's been suddenly some shift in the United States budget such that there's no money available now for keeping the promises that were made by the president and the current vice president. It would be impossible to maintain that as long as the defense budget is increasing on a level of 8% per year, as long as there's the F-22 fighter jet being bought. An accountant couldn't explain to us. Now the reality is such that, we can't afford that any longer. Rather, the shortage, quote-unquote shortage, is a political factor. Right? It's political. It's not necessarily economic in nature. If it were economic or budgetary in nature, then it would have been there would have been discussions and trade-offs. Well, can we now not afford these other things, right? But those kinds of things are not that's not the discussion that we're having. So it's a political thing. And so I think it's important that we really understand that and know that we need to make a really effective political case and not simply assume that now there is this objective shortage that we have to accommodate our arguments to. There is no objective shortage such that these cuts would need to be made, because we're talking about a tiny fraction of the United States budget. Right? It's not a large amount of money that we're talking about to keep these promises. And Vice President Biden said on the campaign trail, he was asked, so now that there's this economic crisis, are you going to keep these promises that you've made? And he said, and the question was, we're concerned that this promise will be dropped. And he said, not on my watch. Right? He said, not on my watch. So that's a promise that we're going to hold him to and President Obama to. But the question I had for you was about quality of medication. I'm wondering if you could comment on the concern that medications using D4T and other medications in the standard antiretroviral regimen on first-line drugs, that's a self-defeating strategy, to be using those kinds of drugs when it comes to adherence, when it comes to the side effects that we're seeing. And would it actually make better sense to roll out higher quality drugs, even if there is an initially greater cost, but that the cost would eventually fall?
Thank you. We have another comment over here. Then we'll come back to Peter.
Actually, a comment and a question. Peter, thank you for your presentation. I think it was quite insightful. I'm sorry, I'm talking to a podium. But I'm Tiffany Atwell from Abbott, and I'm just want to just raise one point. You know, our foundation has done a lot of work in Tanzania to try to refabricate and redo a lot of the labs in that country to help strengthen their healthcare infrastructure. So agree with you on all the points you made, but one thing that we've realized is, you know, one company nor one government can do it alone. And so we are actively working with other foundations and other groups to see how we could all band together to do more healthcare infrastructure building, not just in Tanzania, but other countries. And so I just wanted to get your thoughts on working with companies who, although, believe it or not, we're facing a lot of constraints because of the economic crisis, but companies and groups like the Gates Foundation and other funding groups, not just the U.S. government. So maybe if we broaden the tent, we might be able to do more together.
Thank you. Why don't we come back to you?
Thank you for those questions. Maybe it starts with the last one. It ties up with the, what Samuel asked, Dr. Samuel Adenin-Jones. Yes, that's a brilliant idea. It's not only government that could come to in a partnership to tackle AIDS. NGOs have, that's non-government organizations, private businesses, and other people. In the country and outside the country, the mobilizing such partnership synergies are the kind of initiatives that we need to look for during times of hardship like we have of economic challenges. Now, there was a question about public and private partnerships to promote ownership. I thought that was more of a comment because I agree with the, with that. There was a comment on how policies, better practice, and research can inform capacity building. Absolutely. To give you an example, some of the research that is coming out of these partnerships are informing new ways forward. It ties up with your question of using drugs like D40. D40 is unacceptable, in my view. Those of you who don't treat patients, this drug has become the cheapest because it is not acceptable in the West. When you take it in the short term, it's not so bad. But in the long term, it causes horrific side effects. It drains the fat outside, out of the face. People who use it look like skeletons with the skin hanging on the bones. It causes serious metabolic disorders. And these are not the kind. It is approved by FDA. Once it is approved by FDA, we can use it with the PEPFAR money. But this is what we need to move away from, those kind of practices. And in Uganda, we have moved away from it. But recently, when the hardship came, questions started coming back. If people are going to die, isn't it better to use a drug that gives them these horrific side effects, but at least saves them? I don't think this is the kind of options we need to go into today. That's why all the brains need to be put together. And the imperative nature of maintaining this greatest humanitarian initiative and find out how it can work. Health systems and leadership. Ochan was asking, where are the new ones? Yourself, you are the one. The one who replaced Mugenyi is yourself. You are the new generation. You need to move out of United States back into Uganda. I would feel very, very disappointed if I left JCRC. I don't have graduates. Not graduates. I mean people who have whom I have mentored to take over. I'm very proud to tell you that people who have worked with me are leaders in various NGOs. They are leaders. People who have been to JCRC are highly sought after. And we need other organizations to do the same. And so, yes, Africa is building leaders. We have African Dialogue on AIDS. This dialogue is creating leadership. And this leadership, we have been mentoring people, young people from various parts of Africa, not only Uganda, to take over the mantle. Now, also, there were questions which I can answer as briefly as like this. Africa now has information that can come back to the United States to help tackle the rising cases of HIV. So we are learning lots of lessons from Africa, how to address high-risk groups, how to decrease on stigma. And we have had lots of lessons from US to Africa on how to tackle the epidemic there. So it looks like we are going to be having cross-fertilization for eventual success. So really, I think it is prevention. We are now facing what I call second-generation preventive initiatives. The epidemic is dynamic. What we had 5 years ago, it has changed. In Uganda, as I have explained, we are now dealing with infection in married couples, discordants. They have got higher rates. We need to address that. It is becoming a women's disease. We need initiatives for better women care, women health. We are also finding out that the epidemic is moving from high social groups. We need to reach them, to find ways of reaching them. So prevention now needs to be robust. It does not always mean increased funding, but we can have initiatives that are cheap. But in the short term, increased funding will help us control it in the end. I liked your statement. The way I always put it is this. If you are treating people and others, many more are still getting infected, it is like mopping the floor when the tap is running. You will never finish mopping the floor. We need to close the tap. This is emphasis that treatment and preventions are priorities that must go side by side. They need to be addressed together in a robust manner.
Peter, we've gotten to the end of a very rich time together this afternoon. It's been a real honor to have you here, and I thank you for coming and providing such a thoughtful presentation and taking on all these big issues. I want to also thank PHR, Pat Deust, Gerer, Radhavasyan, and Paolo Barahona for bringing this opportunity to us here today, and I want to thank all of you for coming with us at this key moment here. So please join me in thanking Peter. Thank you.